The program tonight is entitled Since the Light, Artistic Reflections on the Post-Atomic World. Tonight is not a performance, so we ask you not to applaud. Tonight is a remembrance and a time for a collective remembering of the event that happened on this day in 1945, the atomic bombing of Hiroshima. So with that introduction, the artists featured tonight are many and varied. Some of what you will hear is original work. Some of what you will hear is work by artists such as Arthur Kopit, Bob Dylan, many other poets and preachers and speakers and prophets. So we welcome you to the remembrance and invite you to stay for what will be roughly an hour in length.
Creation, Trinity Site, New Mexico, 5:30 a.m., July 16, 1945. Let there be light, and there was light. The sun was slow in arriving that morning, though it was no longer dark, was light enough, and having been born with good eyes, we could see. We stood on the cool cactus sand, which was once an ocean, with a patience we rarely practiced. It was hard to imagine so much water in this place of permanent thirst. Motionless we stood, just as we once waited for our sons to struggle out of our wives. The labor wasn't long, but the longest 10 seconds of our lives. 10 seconds, that was all. And then the man-made flash, twice as large as the sun, photographed the moment in fire, flames burning the sands, slashing the face of the calm. The ball of thunder strangled the sky, reached, blasted, bounced on rocks, became a perfect tower, taller, wider, whiter than the Aztecs ever dreamed of or desired. All the gilded temples where we crossed ourselves and worshipped perished in the smoke. Everything surpassed in the new incense. Falling on our knees, it seemed to reach for us. We prayed for it to stop, yet urged it on. The air exploded hot, grew cold, then hot again, invoking Indian winds to rise, to blow, to break the earth in half. Then it was silent. Motionless we stood, the air throwing us back, and we remembered ourselves, our past, the boyhood houses filled with women singing. We rose, surveyed the aftermath of our great experiment. There was not much damage. Rearranged sand, uprooted bushes, a few dead rabbits. This was, after all, already a desert. Already named Jornada del Muerto, plain of the no-person God. We had seen and lived. We blessed ourselves, smelling the victory. We put on jubilant smiles in the face of the outcome, but the smiles fell off, unable to withstand the great success. The sun was slow in arriving that morning. Those of us who bore witness saw it rise in the new sky, motionless, but it no longer gave enough light. Now, after many years, our eyes have grown accustomed to the dark.
You ever been to the South Pacific? Remarkable place. Beautiful beyond imagining. The imagination belittles its beauty. Anyway, I was there in the early 50s, involved, a close friend of mine was involved in our nuclear tests there and asked if I'd like to go along on the viewing ship. It was not inappropriate for me to be there, for among my many financial interests at the time was a laboratory and development center. It was in Utah. In any event, there we were on this ship, this battleship, not too far from where the detonation was to take place, which was near an island known, interestingly enough, as Christmas Island. We'd been told that the bomb was to be a small one, and so none of us was particularly worried. Even though I'd never seen one go off, I figured, well, these people must know what they're doing. Actually, the truth of it was, I was in kind of a funk. That's because I hadn't come all this way just to see a little bomb. This one was 10 kilotons. That's smaller than the one they used on Hiroshima. These bombs were classified as technical weapons, the kind you'd use in combat. And quite frankly, I was disappointed. I wanted some big-time stuff, and I'm not ashamed to say it either. There's a glitter in nuclear weapons. I had sensed it in others, and I felt it in myself. If you come to these things as a scientist, it's irresistible to feel it's there in your hands, so to speak. The ability to release this energy that fuels the stars, to make it do your bidding, to make it perform miracles, to lift 1 million tons of rock into the sky, and all from a thimbleful of stuff. Irresistible. Well, we were standing by the railing when the countdown came in. We could hear it over the PA. We'd all been adequately briefed, and we were in suits, some kind of lead, tinted visors on our helmets. And then I saw these birds. Albatrosses. Phenomenal creatures. They'd been flying beside our ship for days, accompanying us to the site, so to speak. These birds have tremendously long wings and tails, and beaks that seemed fashioned for another purpose. You can't see what these birds are about from their design. They're just beautiful creatures. Watching them was a wonder. And suddenly, I could see they were smoking. Their feathers were on fire. And they were doing cartwheels. The light persisted for some time. It was instantaneously bright and lingered long enough for me to see the birds crash into the water. They were sizzling, smoking. They were not vaporized. It's just that they were absorbing so much intense radiation that they were being consumed by the heat. And so far, there'd been no shock. None of the blast damage we talk about when we discuss the effects of these bombs. Instead, there was just the smoking, twisting, fantastically contorted birds crashing into things. And I could see vapor rising from the inner lagoon as the surface of the water was heated by this intense flash. Well, I'd never seen anything like it in my life. And I thought, this is what it will be like at the end of time. And we all felt the thrill of that idea.
A red dragonfly flew past and settled on a fence just before me. I stood up, cap in hand, and reached out to catch it. At that moment,
my grandmother was washing egg fruit in the kitchen, my younger sister at my mother's breast. Mother, I want you to buy me a new cap. I was going out to play when I noticed that my skirt was torn. I had just gone back to get it stitched when
our next-door neighbors had a cat. Each day I would bring home a little bottle of milk for it,
that day, as I went out with the milk for the kitten and to play with it.
We had bought tomatoes at the green grocer's, my mother, my sister, and I, and were just leaving the shop. At that moment, for evacuation in the country, four of us, father, mother, sister, and I, went to the Hiroshima railway station to catch the 7:30 train. For some reason, it did not come. Father was leaning against a pillar. Reading the paper, I looked at the clock. It was 8:13. I was tired, and I went to lean against my father's knees.
That morning, I was on my way to go fishing. As I went down to the bridge, it flashed, Pika, with a terrible blast. I came to myself in the water.
Precisely at 8:15, 17 a.m., the bomb bay doors of the Enola Gay snapped open. The plane lurched upwards nearly 10 feet, suddenly 9,000 pounds lighter. Inside the bomb, a timer tripped the first switch in the firing circuit, letting the electricity travel a measured distance toward the detonator. At 5,000 feet above the ground, a barometric switch was triggered. At 1,890 feet, the detonator was activated. The bomb exploding at 8:16, 43 seconds after falling from the Enola Gay. In the first millisecond after detonation, a pinprick of purplish-red light expanded into a glowing fireball a half a mile in diameter. The temperature at its core was 50 million degrees Fahrenheit. At ground zero, some 2,000 feet directly underneath the explosion, the temperatures reached several thousand degrees, melting the surface of granite 1,000 yards away. 900 yards from the epicenter, several thousand soldiers, including one American prisoner of war, were doing their morning exercises in the courtyard at Hiroshima Castle. They were instantly incinerated, their charred bodies burnt into the ground. Watching from below, one child remembered later the entire sequence leading up to this first millisecond. I was watching the airplane the whole time. Suddenly, a thing like a white parachute came falling. 5 or 6 seconds later, everything turned yellow in one instant. It felt the way it does when the sunlight looks straight into your eye. After this first blast of light, the fireball suddenly exploded into a mass of swirling flames and purple clouds, out of which came a huge column of white smoke, which rose to a level of 10,000 feet. At 10,000 feet, the column flattened outwards to form a mushroom-shaped cloud, then climbed upwards until it reached a height of 45 to 50,000 feet. To those on board the Enola Gay observing the scene at an altitude of 29,000 feet, 11 miles away, the scene was quite spectacular. As tail gunner Sergeant George Caron recalls, a column of smoke rising fast. It has a fiery red core, a bubbling mass, purple-gray in color with the red core. It's all turbulent. Fires are springing up everywhere, like flames shooting out of a huge bed of coals. Here comes the mushroom shape, like a mass of bubbling molasses. It's very black, but there is a purplish tint to the cloud. The base of the mushroom looks like a heavy undercast that is shot through with flames. The city must be below that. It was, Caron remembered later, like a peep into hell. The aiming point of the bomb was the central area of Hiroshima, adjacent to the army headquarters, with 60% of the population within 1.2 miles. The drop was accurate to within 200 yards of the aiming point. The explosion created an area of total destruction extending 2 miles in all directions in a flat city of homes and buildings made largely of wood. Within 3 miles of the epicenter, 62,000 out of the 90,000 buildings were destroyed. All utility and transport services were demolished, and 26 out of 33 fire stations were destroyed, leaving only 16 pieces of firefighting equipment to deal with the whole city on fire. 42 of the city's 45 hospitals were devastated, killing 270 of the 298 doctors and 16,000 of the 17,000 nurses. The number of deaths, both immediately and after a period of time, will never be known. They are variously estimated from 63,000 to 240,000. The official U.S. estimate is 78,000, though the city of Hiroshima estimates 200,000. It's safe to say that the entire city became immediately involved in the atomic disaster. Within 1,500 feet of the epicenter, research has concluded that there were 3,483 people. 88% died either instantly or that same day. Only 53 survived beyond a few years. Although mortality was lower if one was indoors, one had to be at least 2,200 yards away from the epicenter to have even a 50% chance of surviving immediate death. The heaviest casualties were among the children.
Give me water.
Oh, give me water to drink.
Let me have some.
I would rather to die.
To die.
Oh.
Help me. Oh, help me.
Water.
A bit of water.
I beg you.
Won't anyone?
Oh, oh.
Oh, oh.
The heavens split.
The streets are gone.
The river.
The river flowing on.
Oh, oh.
Oh, oh.
Night.
Night coming on.
To these parched eyes and sear.
To these lips in flame.
Ah, the moaning of a man.
Of a man.
Reeling.
Whose face is
scorched, smarting.
This ruined face of a man.
There, within a meter of that burnt-out streetcar, lies a boy about 13 years old. Body burned black, eyes open to the sky. Shocked, open-mouthed. The dead lie here and there, to all appearances still alive. But those bodies lie there, charred and stiff. The running, as if still running. Some looking up as if they still see the sky. The shocked, still in a state of shock. All charred, with the burnt, outstretched hands, reaching as if they are alive. Dead bodies lie charred, hands clutching the air. A woman about 30 or so stands mindlessly not far from the hypocenter, holding a bucket. As I come near, saying I belong to the military, she suddenly points at the bucket. There lies the head of a girl, 5 or 6 years old. Past shedding tears, the mother cries, "I was in my old home over the mountains. But my husband's son and daughter are at home. Now are all dead. I could not find my husband or son. Only this head. The head of my daughter I found, lying in the air raid shelter. But her body was nowhere to be seen."
That crowded streetcar, tightly packed, flies through the air and falls, crushed to the earth.
Escaping the flames, clutching bodies floating downstream, I wait for the dawn.
Tearing herself away from the body of her child, she escapes, crying brokenly to have saved herself.
Mother and child, fingers clasped in death, the bodies float in the tank.
Gulping sake, libation to death, burning those bodies, tears streaming.
The heavy bone would be that of the teacher. Beside it lie bones of little heads.
The burned and sunken rice box, with its burden of bones, this only is real.
Bowing before that photograph, her child consumed by flames, She pleads with her to eat the fruit she has offered there. How can I forget that stillness prevailing over the city of 300,000? Amidst that calm, how can I forget the entreaties of departed wife and child through their orbs of eyes, cutting through our minds and souls?
On August 9th, 1945, the city was bombed. Next morning, I found the bodies of two of my children, aged 4 and 1.
These infants had gasped out their lives so near to me. Trees and houses all gone. Now day is dawning. There is nothing I can do. There they lie on the ground, swarming with flies.
My eldest boy, in first year of junior high school, is also dying.
Under the blazing sun, I go to find water for my son's last earthly drink. He spends his last night beside his mother, his face lit by the moon. Two bodies lie outside, and one inside the air raid shelter, the moonlight streaming in.
I go to find some wood for the funeral pyres for my three children.
Out among the dragonflies, I gather wood for the cremation. The breezes blow as I light the fire. My children, the eldest in the middle, are gone.
Next morning, I go to gather the bones.
In the morning mist, the bones of brothers lying together. Little bones, like flower petals, of the pitiful life of a 7-month-old.
The mother of my three children also died at 36.
She talked about the rationing of rice as her last will and testament. I have lost everything. I have only 4 bomb death certificates.
I spent the night in the open, and barely reached a place of refuge to find my daddy only. Mummy and Yu-chan are dead. Next morning, daddy carried an empty box, and I took a hoe on my shoulder as we went into the ruins of the fires in Hiroshima. We arrived at long last to the stench of burning bodies like the smell of pike mackerel. Roof tiles litter the ground, hot with the sun. Silently and absorbed, we search the ground. Ah, mummy's bones. I take them up and the white powder flies in the wind. It is a feeling of utter loneliness. We gather up the bones, placing them in the confectionery box with a soft, dry sound. Beside mummy are my brother's bones, and his flesh, not consumed yet, lying there. Later, all over daddy's body with no visible wounds, spots appear. It is the morning of September 1st. Looking vacantly into the air, daddy said suddenly, "The wind is furious. A storm is coming. A storm." And breathing deeply, he broke down and moved no more. It is less than 1 month, and I am alone. No more tears come. All is vacant before me. I sit and gaze at the river flowing before me, clean and beautiful, blue sky over Hiroshima.
At night, In the basement of a building destroyed, a dark room without even a candle for light, crowded with wounded from the atom bomb. The smell is the smell of blood, the smell of death, the smell of sweat and suffocation and moaning. A strange voice is heard. A baby is about to be born. In this basement, at the bottom of hell, this young woman comes into labor. What can be done in the darkness without even a match? But the people care, forgetting their pains. I am a midwife, I will help her, comes the voice out of the sounds of moans. So, in the depths of this hell of darkness, a child is born. With strength that cannot last till dawn, the midwife dies in blood, helping give birth to life, giving birth to life, giving her own life.
I've stepped in the middle of seven sad forests. I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's hard. Yeah, it's hard. Oh, it's hard. It's hard. It's a hard rain gonna fall. Oh, what did you see, my blue-eyed son? And what did you see, my darling young one? I saw a newborn baby with wild wolves all around it. I saw a highway of diamonds with nobody on it. I saw a black branch with blood that kept dripping. I saw a room full of men with their hammers a-bleeding. I saw a white ladder all covered with water. I saw 10,000 talkers whose tongues were all broken. Saw guns and sharp swords in the hands of young children. And it's hard. Yes, it's a hard. Oh, it's a hard. It's a hard. Yes, it's a hard. Rain I'm gonna fall. So what did you hear, my blue-eyed son? And what did you hear, my darling young one? I heard the sound of a thunder that roared out a warning. I heard the roar of a wave that could drown the whole world. I heard 100 drummers whose hands were blazing. I heard 10,000 whispering and nobody listening. I heard one person starve, I heard many people laughing. I heard the song of a poet who died in the gutter. heard the sound of a clown that cried in the alley. And it's a hard, oh, it's a hard, it's a hard, oh, it's a hard, it's a hard rain gonna fall. Oh, what did you meet, my blue-eyed son? Who did you meet, my darling young one? I met a young child beside a dead pony. I met a white man who walked a black dog. I met a young woman, her body was burning. I met a young girl, she gave me a rainbow. I met one man, he was wounded in love. I met another man who was wounded in hatred. And it's hard. Yeah, it's a hard. Oh, it's a hard. It's a hard. It's a hard rain gonna fall. Oh, what will you do now, my blue-eyed son? And what are you doing now, my darling young one? I'm going back out before the rain starts a-falling. Walk to the depths of the deepest dark forest, where the people are many and their hands are all empty, where the pellets of poison are flooding the waters, where the home in the valley meets the damp, dirty prison, and the executioner's face is always well hidden. Where the hunger is ugly, where the souls are forgotten. Where blackie is the color, where none is the number. And I'll tell it and I'll think it and I'll speak it and I'll breathe it. And reflect from the mountains so that all souls can see it. And I'll stand on the ocean till I start a-sinking. But I'll know my song well before I start to sing it. And it's a hard. Yeah, it's a hard. It's a hard. Oh, it's a hard. It's a hard. Gonna fall.